individuals were designing them. And in the science buildings, which happened to be the first to be opened, except the humanities building, I guess, were designed clearly in a way that was going to try and lay a groundwork for a physical environment that would support research. Other parts of the campus seemed to be doing their longer-range planning for the Stony Brook campus in a way that emphasized instruction more. And I think we saw, for example, a tremendous delay in the final construction of the Fine Arts Center. There had been talk of a Fine Arts Center in 1960, and finally its construction, whenever it was, a very short time ago. So there now came, I think, a host of secondary problems that seemed to perhaps cause a further fractionation, disciplinary fractionation, because we were now involved in a major physical construction process where people measured what the ultimate outcome would be by what the functions were, what functions were being put into the physical facilities.
When you got there in 60 as an assistant professor in chemistry, was it known that they were going to move to Stony Brook?
Yes, it was known, and I can remember the personal decision that I made that means I had to know it. I had been living out in this end of the island because I'd been working at Brookhaven, mm-hmm. and knowing that Stony Brook was going to be its ultimate site, I agreed to relocate near here rather than near Oyster Bay, mm-hmm. In anticipation that the university would join me rather than my having to join it physically for a short period of time. So yes, by the time I had accepted the position, it was known that we would be putting something out at Stony Brook.
Okay. What kind of a person was Lee?
Oh, I admired him greatly. Obviously, I identified myself with the camp that wanted what it was that he had been either brought in to do or decided to do once he had been brought in. He had a mission. It appeared to me from the distance of a faculty member in this case, not from an administrator, so I may here not be quoting fact, but it seemed to me that he had an influence that enabled the a substantial amount of money to be made available to Oyster Bay and presumably to Stony Brook of a magnitude that had not been apparent before. Those were very good days financially. For example, it may be apocryphal, but I remember that our library budget seemed to have grown by some inordinate factor in a very short time that he was there, and the budget for a number of physical facilities that we were having trouble trying to put together suddenly became very large. It's clear Rockefeller was dedicated to pouring money into something that would be successful, and apparently we seemed to have tickled either the fancy of the legislature, the governor, or someone, but we suddenly seemed to be in a lot more money at a very good time enabled to do a lot of things that had been looked at much more modestly before then. I remember our planning for the first chemistry building where we didn't hesitate to plan the acquisition of very expensive scientific equipment. It was just a totally new way of looking at things. We had a small equipment budget before that, which allowed us to bring in a small amount of equipment to do research. All of a sudden it seemed like money was there to do almost anything that one wanted to do. Now, some of that was clearly the construction money that the state had already allocated for the projects out here, which we probably began to use fairly early. Some of it seemed just to be his ability to attract funds to really move the development, accelerate the development of Stony Brook along. So it seemed to me that he appeared to me to have the ability to attract attention and the confidence of people for a while in his ability to put together a major university. Then I guess the fractionation at the campus caused people to take exception on how Lee was proceeding with that development and how what exactly went on there. I don't guess I know, and maybe never will, and maybe don't even want to know.
Right.
I'll read about it when you write the book, Carl.
Don't assume that I'm going to write it.
All right.
I'm just collecting information.
Sure.
The fractionation of the faculty continued after the move to Stony Brook for a short time. I don't know approximately how long it continued, but I think by the time John Toll came into the picture, first as a candidate for the dean of the graduate school, and then later on as a candidate for the presidency, the faculty had pretty well gotten itself straightened out. The largest proportion, I think, of the faculty wanted to get on with the job of building an important university. Do you remember the Heald report?
Yes.
You do. Lee is supposed to have taken that very seriously as the kind of mandate. And Heald was then president of the Ford Foundation. Anything else that strikes you in the early period? What about the attitude of the students toward the administration? Do you remember anything about that?
No, really. I can remember it in the very early classes because of refreshment of my memory that I've gotten in a few reunions of the early classes, and it's remarkable. I mean, they invited, as I'm sure you know, Austell to Oyster Bay. It was 2 years ago or something like that, and they were still adoring the man and cheering him. The alumni of that day, so many of them made comments about how what a tragedy it was that the university had changed into what it was now. I couldn't help chuckling a little bit myself at it. So, yes, they adored Austell, they adored Olson, although I think that adoration was more modest because he was a CEO. Austell was very close to the students on a day-to-day basis, Olson close to them, but from the distance of a CEO, and Olson had to pay equal or more attention to the faculty, of course, not just to the students. Austell spent all his time with the students. I know that the students loved certain individuals, and since the students, many of them had come to a college that had changed, as they continue to remind us, even now, dramatically, they tended to have great respect for those members of the administration who had represented the small college environment, the Chicago college environment, the liberal arts approach, and all of those things. However, I can look back on some of the students that were in the science departments. I think those students equally had great love and respect for specific faculty members, and in some cases, departmental love. I mean, the departments were small enough that it was meaningful to actually think in terms of liking a whole department. So that's all I can really remember of the student feelings of the very early days. In the interim period, I guess while you headed the university, I'm sure that the students that came must have been a little more confused. They must have realized something had happened to this institution. The direction seemed clear now, but I guess for them, to the extent that they had paid any attention to the early history, they must have wondered what was going on in this place a few years ago. And then after that, as you say, the wounds were healed, and I think there was a general sense that we were going to grow and into a major university. I think by that time, then the students became more like students at any other university.
Right. I haven't interviewed any students from that period yet. I'm going to interview Les Pauldy.
Okay.
Very shortly. Do you have any names?
Yes.
That I might.
Yes, that a
Lenny Spivak. Do you remember him?
I remember him. Yes.
Is one.
All right. There's Dolores Baker, who is a physics teacher in the local high school, Warden Melville High School,
oh.
Who was a member of that group. Of course, Judy Pauldy, Les's wife, they were students together.
Oh,
Judy is a biology teacher in the local junior high school. There are quite a few of the very early students who are easily accessible, and I think would love to spend some time with you.
I would like to get some of them together, possibly,
as
a joint interview.
There's Fred Schubert at Suffolk County Community College, who's a chemistry faculty member.
Wait a minute,
there.
S-C-H?
S-C-H-U-B-E-R-T.
Schubert, and where is he?
At Suffolk County Community College. He's, professor of chemistry there.
Okay.
Just trying to think. Oh! There's a person that went on to do very wondrous things, and that's Jesse Nicholson, who has been for many years a professor of chemistry at Howard University.
At Howard?
Howard University, yes. It's kind of interesting. There were four graduates in the first...
Professor of
chemistry.
Chemistry.
Yeah, I knew the chemist best. That's why I tended to remember...
At Howard.
At Howard University.
Now, was he black?
He was black, yes. The first graduating class had a black, a woman, and two males in it, which was kind of an interesting tribute.
Right. And Dolores Baker
She's a physics teacher.
Where?
At Warden Melville High School.
Warden Melville. Okay.
Judy Pauldy is at... Murphy Junior High School.
All right. Leonard Spivak, I think he is in New York.
Okay.
And there was another chap who was in Connecticut, was vice president of the class or president of the class at one point. He is in research. His company gets behind small research projects and funds them.
Venture capital kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know who that is, but...
Oh,
there's another one from the early classes. Patrick Barry.
Patrick
who
Barry.
Has been at Grumman since, I think, he graduated from Stony Brook. In fact, he had an adjunct appointment at Stony Brook for many years in electrical engineering. Oh, there's someone to call. His name is Marchese, Joseph Marchese. He's not from the first class. I think he was the class of 62 or 60, maybe even 63.
Uh-huh.
We had the pleasure, he's at Grumman Data Systems. We had the pleasure when we needed some help from Grumman in the computing area of having him serve for a period of 9 months as director of the computing center here at Stony Brook.
Right.
So he came back 19 years later and spent almost a year with us.
Where was Jack Heller?
Jack joined us from NYU. Jack Heller, the faculty member.
Yes.
Oh, Jack is in the computer science department.
Yeah,
this fellow served as director of the computing center, the service facility.
Okay,
but he was a graduate of Stony Brook.
Hmm.
You probably saw the recent article in the alumni paper about Jeffrey Raskin.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, that's an exciting case. He was an early student who actually developed basically the architecture of the Apple computers.
Really?
On the basis of Apple. He's no longer with Apple, but there's a big article on him in the most recent journal that Alumni Affairs puts out. He'd be fascinating to get back here.
Okay.
There are a lot more students, of course.
Okay. Well, we can get the names at least of the class presidents.
Yes.
That group. I haven't started that yet.
All right. Oh, that should be interesting.
Right.
Get some insights.
Okay. Do you want to switch to your present work? How was it, and when did you switch over?
Okay. All right. I had had, as you know, because I think it happened while you were the CEO of the campus, I had a little bit of difficulty in my tenure. But it worked out that I was finally given tenure at the assistant professor level, which I appreciated, and I think I hope that after that motion of trust on the part of my department that they were not regretful of their decision.
I'm sure they weren't.
I did engage in research fairly heavily. I did the first PhD student from Stony Brook, in fact, was an advisee of mine, and so was the third. I was fortunate in having really, truly excellent students at the graduate level in the early days. I was in an area of research that was exciting, but seemed not to have an extremely long future. I got funding from outside, from the NSF. I had funding for a period of 6 or 7 years, I think. Perfectly fine funding enabled me to support graduate students and a number of other things. The graduate student clientele changed, and I acquired a graduate student with whom I had a little bit of academic difficulty. And I guess I began to do some soul searching on what I was going to do longer term. Would I change the area of chemistry that I was in, or would I look for other things to do? Ironically, I was out giving a seminar on my research at the University of Kentucky when I got a phone call. When I came back from Lexington, I was a phone call waiting for me from the graduate school. It turned out a fellow named Gary Thomas, who was an electrical engineering faculty member, and who had played the role of associate, I guess at that time, associate dean for research under Herb Weisinger, had left a message for me. When I returned the call, he asked me would I be interested in, I think the way he put it, was helping him. And I went over and chatted with him and got the impression that there was an opportunity here for a part-time administrative job over in the graduate school. I didn't know that Gary was about to step down from that position. He hadn't quite told me that in the early stages. Met with Weisinger, and we hit it off. He and I, think, agreed that we could work together, although I have to admit that he was not my hero as a faculty member, having come from the science side, but I could still see some marvelous things that he initiated. And he was a marvelous individual in spite of whatever we may have said about him over his years. Herb said if I was interested in this position, I could have it. By then it became clear. In fact, I went back to the department and told them I'd been given this opportunity. And asked them what was their feeling about it. And they said, fine, as long as I understood that to go and do administrative work now would mean that I would stay at my current level of academic advancement, that there was no way in which they could use whatever contributions I might make in that area towards any further academic advancement in chemistry. They wished me well with taking on the academic position. I thought it was part-time. I kind of expected to continue to have graduate students and engage in research at less than full time. Within 2 months of having taken that job and realizing that Gary Thomas was leaving it, it became clear that I was not going to have time to do any more research. I did remain in, I accepted the job, obviously, and I've had that position, although it has changed its name because my immediate supervisor has changed his or her name quite a few times since 1973. I guess it was June of 73 when that opportunity arose. The dean was replaced by
This is Weisinger?
Dean Weisinger was replaced, I guess, by Vice President Beagle. I remember correctly.
Jay,
I think Jay,
that's right.
Jay came, and that the position of research was elevated to a vice presidential position with all the complexities that had to do with dual reporting to both the provost on the one hand, the graduate side, and directly to the president on the research side. So I became associate, I guess I was still called associate dean, because I don't remember what it was. But then, of course, we went to a vice provostial structure, and now that same position is called associate vice provost for research. The opportunity looked interesting to me. I liked research. I knew the faculty very well, having been here already for 13 years by the time that the opportunity was given me, and I thought that it would be, I thought I could do something useful in that area by bringing a faculty perspective, as had Gary Thomas, my predecessor, also to that position. So I did take it, and started with an office that had a half-time secretary and two full-time employees, one of whom worked on a newsletter, and one of whom handled all of the grant applications of the institution. And I think developed that office over the years into certainly a larger office. I think an office.
Just give me the names, will you?
With pleasure. Yes, the lady who did the newsletter was Harriet Christman, and the person who was doing the grant review process was Lois Branch. The half-time secretary was Alice, I believe it was Davidson, but I won't swear to the last name. I can check, but that was the entire staff of the research administration.
Who was your predecessor in research advising?
Okay, it was Gary Thomas Gary had held that position for a really relatively short period of time, and had taken it after the fairly peculiar problem that the campus had had in 1970 or 1971, the affair in which there had been embezzlement in the research office.
Yes, I see.
Yeah, we had had a very unfortunate. The research office had been an integrated office. It did both the academic functions. It was Don Ackerman, I guess, who was the person that had that position. He did both the academic functions, the development functions, and also managed, to some extent, the funding. And as you know, we had a problem there, the result of which was a very clean and very hard division of the fiscal and academic functions on the research side. It had been an audit of our procedures and processes, commissioned by the then Vice President for Finance, Joe Diana, who you, I'm sure, remember. And that audit had exposed the fact that we had a system that did not have adequate controls on the fiscal side, and therefore the function had drifted to Herb Weisinger, the research function, which previously, I think, had been freestanding. It was never quite clear to me whether Ackerman reported to Weisinger or reported directly to John. I just didn't know for sure, but certainly after that difficulty, Weisinger inherited the academic aspects of research administration, and Diana, the fiscal management of the research enterprise. Ackerman, I guess, had been the first one brought in to do a range of activities, including development of proposals, information dissemination about proposals, but had a lot of other functions as well.
Okay.
It's ironic, I might just add, in passing and only for your interest, that we are about to bring to closure the refusion of the principal fiscal office that handles research matters and my office. The so-called Grants Management Office and Office of Research Administration will be rejoined on October 3 or something like that. Okay, so we have existed for 1973, 88, 15 years, totally separated as a result of that problem, and we're now ready to rejoin them because we think we've grown enough to be able to manage those activities.
Yeah. Who's heading it?
It will be under the Vice Provost for Research and Graduate Studies, and I guess I'll have the responsibility for the combined offices.
Good. Good.
It's been an interesting office. I brought with me some data, which I'll leave with you, on a history of our external funding since 1972.
Great.
So you have a record.
Good, that's fine. I had the feeling that we were able to present for the Middle States inspection of 1963, I think it was. I hadn't been here very long before we were looked at by Middle States. And the chairman of the visiting committee was the man who had been chairman of the committee that visited Bucknell the year before, when I was, where I was dean.
Yes.
So I knew him. And we have some records of the report of the committee. But I think John Toll felt the place was in sufficiently good shape for him to take over and take a chance to build. I think if it hadn't been, he wouldn't have come.
No.
You're right. Yes.
And I think one of the key people in bringing him in was probably Alec Potter. Because they knew each other. Princeton people. Alec came the same year I did, 62. Okay. Those were the days when money was relatively free and we had good support in the governor's office. Rockefeller was a Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth.
Yes.
One other thing, your relations with the research office in the central office.
Research Foundation?
Research Foundation.
All right.
Do you want to go into that in some way?
Oh, I'd love to. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. When I had been a faculty member funded by NSF through the Research Foundation, along with my colleagues, I had always not the choicest things to say about the existence of that foundation. As I guess happens when you change your function, you get a new perspective on things, and I now understand that the had it not been for the Research Foundation, Stony Brook would literally not be today. I mean, I think it would not exist. Not only would it not be a research university, I think it would not exist at all. I think a tribute to the early, to the trustees back in, whenever it was that the Research Foundation was created, that they recognized that if the SUNY system was ever to do anything creative or imaginative with funding other than its own state operating funds, that it would be impossible without some buffer between the state system and the outside agencies. There's an apocryphal story which takes only 15 seconds to tell, and that is that when whatever it was called, the Brooklyn College of Medicine, was bought by SUNY to become Downstate Medical College, shortly after that they received an NIH grant for a piece of equipment. The legislature didn't quite know what to do. It was the first grant that had come in from a major federal agency to a SUNY campus. It took the legislature precisely 1 year to try and figure out how they would handle those funds, by which time the grant had terminated. I'm not sure that's apocryphal. It was told to me once as a true story, and it was that apparently which made them realize that no matter whether they were university centers or not, if they were health centers, that we're going to be heavily involved with external funding, that the state bureaucracy and the legislative process and all of the other processes were just not going to let people proceed with the kind of speed and simplicity that is necessary in the useful application of external funds towards research training and research-related activities. So the Research Foundation came into being as a result of the trustees' farsightedness, I think, in that regard. And the major problem that I think the Research Foundation had in the 60s was that its director, Mort Grant, who became actually a very good friend of mine later on, I think he missed his golden opportunity. He did not cultivate among the faculty a constituency. He paid more attention to the corporation, to the Research Foundation as a corporation, and a little bit too little attention, I think, to the real constituency, which was the faculty. So the Research Foundation became a symbol of a separate bureaucracy and not a substitute for a bureaucracy. And I must admit that I used to complain myself about a number of what I thought at that time were Research Foundation practices. It turned out, now that I can look back in retrospect, I was complaining about campus practices, or campus implementations often of Research Foundation practices. But there were some distinct complexities. It produced a second employer situation, which had which was a problem, and during the summer the faculty were the creatures of a separate corporation, not of the state. Obvious advantages to that, some trivial disadvantages, that you were taxed at that time Social Security in excess of what you would have been, something which is recoverable later on. But nevertheless, there were a lot of little things that had to do with a two-employer situation that people who had come from so-called normal universities found objectionable. Why did we need a separate corporation? Well, any of them who dealt with the state for any period of time, which is true of very few faculty, it may be true of some chairman, it's true certainly of deans, but most faculty do not deal with the state bureaucracy. They deal with the local bureaucracy and its presentation of the state bureaucracy. So the faculty are, honestly, and my colleagues will hate me for saying it, they're in a very poor position to be able to evaluate the relative merits of one bureaucracy or another, since they deal probably with only one. If they are a research faculty, they deal with the Research Foundation. If they're not, they deal only with the local campus bureaucracy. Nevertheless, the Research Foundation existed. It had failed to build a very strong constituency, although there were a few people on our campus who understood that the Research Foundation was critical to the growth of the campus if it were to become a research university. One was Francis Bonner, of course, who served on, again, many of the major committees, major Research Foundation committees, including one which sought to and succeeded in completely revising the advisory structure of the Research Foundation to inject more and more of the end-user community in the advisory structure. Another one was David Fox, who was very active with the Research Foundation. David was Dean of Graduate Studies for quite a while, and he played a role with the Research Foundation. My predecessor, Gary Thomas, also did, and he became one of the first fighters with the Research Foundation. I remember when I came up, the first thing they told me was that they hoped I would not be like Gary Thomas. I think for the first couple of years I was exactly like Gary Thomas and fought them in a friendly way whenever they tried to institute policies that I thought might not be beneficial to Stony Brook.
This Research Foundation was located in Albany, and it was university-wide
right.
in its responsibilities. I know that we complained that it seemed to be siphoning off some of the administrative funds.
Right.
How it did it, I was never quite sure.
Yes. It had been given the authority under its charter to collect on behalf of the state university systems those indirect costs that came from external sponsors. It was obligated to do nothing with those indirect costs, and in fact, what it did was to run its own operating costs from them, which were relatively large in those days. The foundation was larger than it needed to be in the early days. It then turned out to be smaller than it needed to be in the interim days. It's now again perhaps larger, but for complicated reasons. Yes, it was accused of siphoning off indirect costs, and in response to that, it began a program of return of indirect costs to the campuses to support the campus administrative structure for research by complex formulas of one sort or another.
But we at Stony Brook felt that we were contributing into
yes.
the foundation a lot more than we got back.
We got back, and that was true because the bases for the distribution had been dictated primarily by the medical centers, which were the only two organizations to have research in the SUNY system before Stony Brook even was a part of the system. Stony Brook was the first non-medical university to be engaged in research of any kind at all, and it was small compared to the two medical schools when it began. Of course, we bought Buffalo later on, which became then a kind of an interesting challenge, because although it was not a major research university and it had almost gone into receivership of the Health Science Center, it turned around to what it is today. But Yeah, so we took exception, I think, to the fact that there had been a series of policies instituted that made the net flow of indirect costs to Stony Brook less than we felt was our entitlement.
Right.
That is, in fact, still to a small extent the case. There are still some policies that provide for the return of indirect costs in a way that is other than their generation. But it's done now in a way that I think makes it, while no more palatable to the campus, a little bit more understandable. The thing is, of course, nobody paid any attention to the Research Foundation in the 60s other than SUNY itself. It was a small corporation. By the time we joined it, I doubt that it was more than a 15 or at most $20 million corporation. It's now, of course, a $280 million corporation. And somewhere in the late 60s, we looked it up the other day, and I can't remember exactly what year, it caught the attention of other people in the Albany area who said, hey, the foundation is collecting these indirect costs. Those are truly, and they are, to some extent, well, they are all, state expenditures. Shouldn't we be getting our share of those? And of course, the practice was instituted of a tithe in which the Research Foundation turned over into the SUNY Income Fund on an annual basis an amount of money that was available to SUNY or relieved it from some of its financial obligations by being in the Income Fund. The tragedy there was, and the one who kept pointing this out early on, was again Bonner, who pointed out that the basis for the establishment of the tithe was never rational. It was done on a year-to-year basis. It was not capped in any way. Sometimes the state elected, for whatever reason, not to increase the tithes from one year to the next, and then the following year, it would increase it very dramatically.
Tithes, T-I-T-H-E-S?
Yes, exactly. It began,
10%?
Became called the tithes. It was usually a fixed dollar amount, which was the other thing that annoyed us immensely, because it started, I think, with a $600,000 contribution to the tithe the first year. Next year it was raised to $1 million. With no particular rationale. These were numbers that were established by no rational process. Bonner, I remember, strongly argued, we understand a justification for the transfer of some of those funds, but they ought to be based in a rational way so that you can do planning. And his criticism, and that of many of us at that time, was, please put in place a rational system that at least allows us to predict if we bring in so much indirect cost revenue that we will have available for our own use so much, and SUNY will have available to it for its own use whatever fixed proportion there is. The other shame, of course, was that while the tithe was going into the income fund, there was no way to assure that the net use of the money that was being transferred from the Research Foundation to SUNY would support the research enterprise. There were no strings attached to this money, so that it could be used virtually to offset costs in any area. And that, I think, increased the resentment of the faculty, because now not only was their money being siphoned off the top to SUNY, but it was being put back in such a way that the research enterprise did not necessarily benefit from.
Is that true still?
No, but in the most peculiar way. And that is that, of course, when the GRI became a reality and the state realized it really wasn't going to invest as much money as it had hoped to invest in the GRI.
Now, what's the GRI?
Oh, the Graduate Research Initiative of 2 years ago.
2 years
right?
ago.
The state realized it would have to come up with cash. And what it said was, finally, well, we'll just jack up the tithe by that time to reach $8 million. The state said, let us first assure that those $8 million, the faculty have been complaining, it's not used for research. What we will do is fund the Graduate and Research Initiative to a major extent out of the returned indirect costs. That at least had the net effect that the tithe now went to the direct offset of graduate and research activities within SUNY. And I know in my own discussions with legislators and legislative assistants, there was a perception outside of SUNY itself in Albany that SUNY was not paying the proper attention to research in the SUNY system. And the tithe was one example of that.
Who were those people?
Which legislators?
Yes.
Well, one prime one I remember having long discussions. Well, Carl Carlucci, of course, understands this whole situation extremely well.
Where is he?
He is now the chief staff officer to the State Ways and Means Committee.
He hasn't gone back to Brooklyn?
To Brooklyn, no. He is in Albany on a rather permanent basis.
Was he ever on our faculty?
He was at least a staff member under Alec.
Right.
And Carl had great admiration for Alec and for Stony Brook. He has very fond memories, by the way, of Stony Brook. So he's never intentionally done anything to us to hurt us, although his own perceptions in some instances of the flow of money between the Research Foundation and SUNY and the division of the budget and the involvement of all these complex organizations has raised in his mind questions from time to time about whether funds, I guess the way they phrase it is the bypass of legislative intent. The existence of this separate corporate entity called the Research Foundation provides SUNY in principle with a way to bypass legislative intent. Legislature would love to, as it does in other states, appropriate the external funds. It then feels that it has spoken to the use of those funds. Fortunately, I think we've avoided the direct appropriation of sponsored funds in New York State, and I hope that remains the case, although it's an annual threat. Annually, some senator...
Direct appropriation of sponsored funds.
Right. For example, in other states, the legislature must act to accept the funds from the federal government that come as grants to the university. Now, they may have a mechanism that makes it simple so that there aren't delays if the legislature is out of session. They may have ways around it and things of that type. There have been moves to do the same thing in New York State many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for us, Cornell has a major piece of state-operated institution. It is Cornell that generally finally lobbies to prevent those things because they are afraid of having to operate their state contractors part under legislative intent. So the legislature has not fully understood the problem, but it has been suspicious that SUNY does not always put money which appears to it earmarked for a specific mission into that mission. And one of the ways in which it tried to correct that was by funding a major part of the Graduate Research Initiative out of indirect cost funds. And that amount has now risen to almost $15 million out of a not much larger amount than that, out of perhaps 22 or 23 million. 15 million are now indirect costs. The faculty, on the other hand, argue that those indirect costs are theirs, or at least the local
campuses.
They're generated by them. The legislature says, no, they're not generated. They may be generated by you, but they're expended by the state in support of the research enterprise. We're not asking to take them back from you, but we're asking you to invest them in the research enterprise within your own institution. It's a complicated argument that nobody will ever win. So yes, the Research Foundation has changed its approach, posture, and everything else very dramatically over the past decade and a half that I have been involved with it. It has become a much more responsive organization to end users. Had it developed that particular constituency earlier on, it could have probably helped itself even more and geared itself for defense against some of the things that went on in between, like the institution of the tithe in an irrational way. Mm-hmm. It took 10 years to rationalize the tithe, not in a way that I like, but at least it's rationalized now. Had they had the faculty constituency at that time, they might very well have avoided some of those problems and found that money flowing back into the research enterprise instantly. It's also been an extreme mode of decentralization, and more of its activities are now performed actually on the campus rather than by the central office. And it continues in that mode now under heavy pressure from SUNY Buffalo, which would like to see all of its functions transferred basically, that's an exaggeration, but basically all but the very small number of corporate functions that it provides to the campus, with campus people involved. Stony Brook current practice is still to use the Central Research Foundation staff for a variety of assisting operations, if not direct contact with the faculty.
The Central Research Foundation staff is in Albany. Are any of them on any of the campuses?
The precedent was set at Buffalo with the first instance of a person who would normally have been an employee of the central office being located at the campus, and that was a technology transfer individual. We have a technology transfer individual on our campus who we support out of returned indirect costs, in fact, in our office, in the office, research administration at Buffalo. The Research Foundation agreed with Buffalo to move an individual to the Buffalo campus. Trouble is it begins to be a complicated issue. For example, we have 130 or 140 employees of the Research Foundation on our campus who perform administrative functions.
Really?
My entire office, for example, are Research Foundation employees.
I see. Not our employees at all.
Not state employees. They are Research Foundation, but they are campus employees. They are indistinguishable from their state supported counterparts, right? So we have on campus 150 administrative support individuals at the moment who support the research enterprise who are paid out of returned indirect funds.
I see.
All right. Buffalo has much fewer. When Buffalo moved into the state system, it already had positions for the states, well, at that time privately supported, but converted to state supported positions for the same functions that John Toll basically decided we would fund out of returned indirect costs.